Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lee from the Lee and Keys Real Talk Podcast. My man Keys, he can't be with us tonight. He's busy with school. But I got a special guest host tonight. One of my longtime friends met Endeavor, I think back in 2003, and we've been friends ever since. And tonight, me and him will chop it up a little bit. It's really not gonna be a talk show like we normally have. You know, we talk about sports and all this and all that, but we're gonna have a conversation. like I said, I'm Lee. I'm Endeavor. My man Dre, he's in Virginia by way of Denver, and that's kind of funny because I'm in Denver by way of Virginia, but it's all good. I want to talk about something real quick. Today is my son Dontre's 20th birthday. I kind of remember my 20th birthday like it was yesterday. You know, I was in the Air Force, came in the Air Force when I was 18. And then they sent me to Germany, and I spent my 20th birthday in Germany. And, you know, Germany was a great, great experience. I mean, being 18, you could drink legally. My first car was a Benz. I couldn't drive because I didn't have a stateside driver's license. But my wife could, and our first car was a Benz. But my man Dre is now with us. What's up, Dre? How goes it, bro?
What the deal, son?
Nothing, man. I was just about to tell the people about how me and you met.
I don't even remember, yo. I don't remember. Weren't you working at the?
Okay.
Weren't you working at the flea market?
Oh man, go ahead with that, Bulls. Nah, Dre. I met Dre. We was playing intramural basketball when I was in the Air Force. And Dre, Dre was just coming off injury, so he couldn't play. So he was our coach. And I used to always be like, why is he always so G'd up coming to coach an intramural basketball game? And, man, it was funny because our team, we looked good in warm-ups. But, oh, my God, we didn't play good together. And they used to drive Dre crazy on the sideline. So once Dre got healthy, we used to, our crew used to be, we called ourselves the Grinders. We would always meet at the gym on Saturday, and we would just hoop it up against each other. And it always came to be that me and Dre would be on opposite sides. I don't think we ever played together back in the day. It was always on opposite sides.
Used to get this work.
Oh, my God. Here we go. I got to say, we were always very competitive. And the funny part is everybody in our crew was very competitive. But after we finished balling, we got it in. Hey, we would go somewhere, buy some brews, and go to somebody's house and kick it. Probably for about 2 hours, and then meet up later on that night and go hang out. But that's how I met Dre, man. What's up, Dre? How you doing?
But yo, man, I thought I met you when you was working part-time at Target. That's what I thought I met you at. Remember you was in there? You used to do the, I don't know if you was doing, what was that you were doing? Either security. Weren't you doing security for Target?
Yeah, I was doing security. But we had already met before then.
Oh, well, you know, my mind is bad, son. That was years ago.
Yeah, I started working at Target after that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I just took that gig at Target as like a second job or whatever. So, yeah. So, what's up, man? How was your day today?
Yo, man, it was all good. Yo, out here in VA. One thing is,
what's the weather like?
It's mild weather, yo. It's not snowing. It's not cold. It's just, it's a nice fall day. So, You know what I mean? You know, like in Denver about this time, you know, you get up in the morning, it's 35 below zero. You all got the snow coat on and the boots. You got to go out and warm the whip up before you take off. You know what I mean? You're real frosty. You're real frosty when you leave the crib when you're in Colorado, yo. It's frostiness.
That was kind of crazy, but, though, because it's crazy because, like, this weekend, it was about 65, almost 70 degrees. Monday, the high was 35, and it was, like, 18 degrees in the morning. Today, it was 19 degrees in the morning, and the high was, like, 40. Man, I was like, man, come on, man. You know, I'd rather just be, like, 50. Just give me 50.
Right.
I'm good.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's Colorado weather, man. It'll change on you in a minute. One thing is you're going to get four distinct seasons, no doubt. You're going to know when it's fall. You're going to know when it's spring. But at the same time, during the course of those seasons, man, it is definitely going to change up on you. You got to, in the springtime, you got to take an umbrella with you, even though they may say it's going to be, you know, no clouds, 80 degrees. You still got to take an umbrella because it might decide to snow on your ass.
But it's kind of crazy because I was telling everybody, you in Virginia by way of Denver, and I'm in Denver by way of Virginia.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Hey, but look, man, I want to talk about something tonight. You know, me and you, we got an affinity for historically black colleges and universities.
As where I currently
I know
am employed.
Hampton University. Yep.
Yeah.
You went to Hampton University.
The real HU in the building.
Huh? You attended the real Hampton back in the day too, right?
No, I've always just worked here, but I tell people I went to school here too, just so I can, just so I say, yeah, I got the school. You know what I'm saying? I'm gonna love this. You know what I mean? Now I got my degree at Platt College,
okay.
But yeah, people ask me like, yeah, I went to Hampton and I worked there.
Okay, so look, man, tell me about, you know, a lot of people don't know about HBCUs, and me and you, we both love them. Hey, man, tell me about working on the campus of HBCU. You know what you love about the HBCU community. And I ain't gonna really say tell me something you hate. Just tell me something that you wish that would change about the reputation of HBCUs.
Well, you know, the one thing I love about working at HBCU is that it's actually cuts both ways, because what I'm going to say is going to make sense both ways. I love it because of the family environment, but I also hate it because of the family environment. You know what I'm saying? Because just like your family at home, you love them to death and you get them and you grew up with them and they know you, you know me, you know them, they know you, and you got love and you got to chill, blah, blah, blah. But then you also have those times when they get on your nerves. And as black people, we have a very unique culture as far as how we interact with our families and, you know, the traditions that we have and that type of thing. So you find that rooted in HBCUs for the mere fact they were brought about for us to be able to achieve and get the education that wasn't being allowed for us within society at that time. So it cuts both ways in that sense. There's challenges with HBCUs, and it comes across, and I've worked in HBCUs for most of my life, and let me rephrase that. I worked for HBCU twice, and it was at Hampton both times, but I've also worked at a state school, which is DU, back in Colorado. So I was able to compare the two and get a taste of both sides of it. And to be completely honest with you, they're very similar in the fact that there's still politics, you know, there's still a culture, environment, culture. So, you know, people that walk around with a doctor, PhD, their name is still a certain kind of way how, you know, they feel like they can talk to you, or because they have that, they feel like smarter than you. You find that in both environments. But one of the challenges with HBCUs is sometimes you carry over
and we perpetuate that mentality that people see us as black people owning businesses and, you know, not really being successful all the time. And it's, you know, it's a technology thing too. You know, sometimes it's difficult to get people to lock in and try new technologies because the culture is so ingrained and they're so used to doing things a certain way. And so it has its challenges both ways. But if I didn't love it the way that I do, I wouldn't have come back to campus. I wouldn't have came back to Hampton University. And lastly, go ahead.
It's kind of crazy that, you know, the challenges of HBCU in today's time, because most of the HBCUs that came a long way, remember HBCUs, they didn't even used to be Division I or Division II. They was like under that. And now most of the HBCUs are at least in Division I. They consider Division I schools as far as sports. So it's kind of crazy the challenges they still have. And then for you growing up out here in Denver, where there isn't a historically black college, it's kind of great how you gravitated towards HBCU once you moved away from home. So go ahead and finish your point, man. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, you're good. The only other thing I was going to say was the other reason why I came back this way is because my mentor was my first boss. He opened up a lot of opportunities for me coming out of the military and allowing me to come on board. This was my first tech gig. So they were instrumental in not only getting me on board, and he showed me and taught me a lot just from being in a management position,
how to carry myself in that environment and my expectations and her expectations of me. And she just really molded me into who I am as far as from a work perspective. And I've always carried everything that she told me and showed me since then. So that was one of the reasons why I came back here, was because of the fact that she was allowing me to learn so much more.
Well, you know, it's kind of, you know that when I graduated from high school, I kind of sort of figured I wasn't going to go to college. But when I did apply to go to different schools, I applied for Norfolk State, Howard, University of Virginia. It was either North Carolina A&T or North Carolina Central, one of those. And you know, I was just like, if I'm going to go to college, it's definitely going to be a black college. Because, you know, growing up, I lived in an all-black neighborhood up there, and I went to an all-black school, high school. So I was like, yo, I'm going to go to an HBCU. Plus, it was just something about being around your own people. You know, they could be good or bad. You know, just take that for what it is. But as long as you're going to school for all the right reasons, you're going to have a college experience regardless of where you go. And for people that have never been to a HBCU event, if you get a chance, just go to one event. I know me and Dre this year, I got to go home, and I went to Hampton's homecoming. And it was such a festive event. It was people that's probably graduated 30, 40 years ago there. Then you probably have people that graduated 2-3 years ago there. But the atmosphere was so family-based. It was fun. It was cool. It was a good time. Want no drama. Oh, man, I had a good time. I was expecting to enjoy myself, but I wasn't expecting to enjoy myself like that. That was a good time, man. Oh, my goodness gracious. But,
well,
Another thing about HBCU that everybody knows is the bands. If you ever go to an HBCU football game, the halftime show will get you off your seat. People don't go and get popcorn and drinks during halftime when you go to an HBCU game. That just doesn't happen. Dre, I know you've been to plenty of football games this year. How many halftime shows have the stands been empty?
It depends. It depends because you have to remember, too, here it is to be expected. So they're kind of they're spoiled. So here they may get up and back and
that's
forth.
True.
You know what I mean? Because they know what it is,
yeah,
and they've already sat through, you know, six or seven games. However, when, like, HU has the game against Norfolk, Battle of the Bays, or the Battle of the HUs, Howard University and Hampton University, people stay in their seats during those times because that's when the bands do come out, and that's when it's really jumping. That's when it's really live. And it's a cultural thing because, you know, HBCUs and the band is an expression of the school. So back in the day, you know, you being on the band, and still to this day, you being on the band is almost, if not as much, but almost level as being on the football team. You know what I'm saying? Because a lot of bands, that's where their money come in. That's where their money come in. So like Southern University, there's another one I can't think of off the top of my head, but there's Jackson State. Their band, you know, they recruit band members like Miami Hurricanes recruit football players. You know what I mean? And that's just ingrained. That's just ingrained in the culture. So, you know, they have the Battles of the Bands down in Louisiana, and that's coming up if it already hasn't happened. That down there every year is a festivity within itself.
Talk about the Southern Classic?
Yeah, Southern Classic.
Between Grambling and Southern? Yeah, they had 2 weekends ago.
It was 2 weeks ago, but I thought, what year is the, because I saw the advertisements at the school, but there's the Battle of the Bands for all the HBCUs.
That's
what I'm talking about.
No, the Battle of the Bands is a different event. I know what you're talking about. That was my bad. I thought you were just talking about Southern Classic. Yeah, the Battle of the Bands.
Southern Classic is classic, too.
Yeah, but the Battle of the Bands, I want to say, is it not in Atlanta no more?
It still might be. I had the flyers. We were sending the flyers out last week, and I just can't remember if it was this past weekend or if it was the weekend before, but it was coming up because it was real close to when the basketball season started for us and our first two games.
But, you know, I find it kind of funny that we're talking about the Bears right now. But I saw a tweet the other day, and that's going to segue me into this topic, which that me and you can expound on. Somebody said, thanks to some people I had never heard of before in my life, for a great year at R&B. And I was like, I haven't heard any good R&B music this year, maybe last year, the year before. So, man, what has happened to R&B music?
Well, let me answer your question with a question. Who would you classify as R&B right now?
Oh, man, if I had to say right now, probably Miguel. I could get into his stuff. Trey Songz a little bit.
You think so? You think Trey Songz is R&B?
Yeah, Trey Songz just a little bit. I would say Trey Songz. I would say Miguel. I think the young lady SZA. I kind of like her stuff a little bit too. Maybe Bruno Mars. Maybe. R&B ain't what
Bruno.
It was.
I can give you Bruno.
R&B ain't what it was in the '80s and nineties when you had somebody that could sing a song and you'll either be listening to the radio or your CD player or tape player and you singing the song and you know the song got meaning to you. I mean, nowadays, most of these songs are like, it's like they're not singing, they kind of like rapping over like a rhythm and blues beat or it's an up-tempo hip-hop beat. it ain't R&B like what me and you grew up listening to. You know what I mean?
Well, you know,
let's just say.
Go ahead.
Let me ask you this: what's the last great slow song you heard? The last good slow song you heard?
Dude.
Now say it.
No, I'm. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to think. The last slow song.
Yeah.
Man, that would have to be something that I heard off of my Pandora like yesterday. Who was that? You're Breaking My Heart. Don't tip my tongue. Not Jodeci. Jodeci too, but it's not Jodeci what I'm thinking about. But it would have to be in the vein of a Dean Hill, Donnell Jones.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So,
but nobody recent.
But back to my question.
Nobody recent.
So what happened to R&B music, man? What happened? Do you know? Can you, like, enlighten me?
Sure, I can enlighten you because you know I'm more intelligent than you are anyway. So I can formulate. I can formulate.
You know that's
an
debatable,
answer.
But go ahead.
Debatable by who? Because you don't count.
Go ahead, man. I'm listening, man, while you're talking.
I would have to say, you know, I would have to say R&B. Has fallen into the same, for lack of a better word, I won't say trap, but the same area that old school hip hop, old school music that we used to listen to back in the day. As you look at new artists and look at what not society, but what our culture is asking for, and the taste of millennials and the new kids listening to the music, and just how hip hop, as it always does, morphs and changes and grows into different types of music and different tastes. R&B has just kind of fallen to the side because there's not any soloist and artist such as your Whitney Houston's, your Luther Vandross, your there's somebody else on tip my tongue. I would say like your Mary J. Blige, who not only was able to bridge between just straight R&B, but was able to do a little of the hip hop in there too, to kind of get
too. Yeah.
Yeah, those collabs, you know, all those different things. So now it's a different sound. It's a different style. And so if you can, I'll even do you one better. If you can even name me a real R&B soloist and or artist right now on the same line that sings like that, besides somebody like what's your girl's name? The white chick from London.
Adele.
Yeah. You know, Adele, or I like, and it's just sad that all these names are just, I just can't reach out and grab them. You know, on the tip of my tongue, you have Adele, and then who's the chick that won, not The Voice, but won, the whatchamacallit show used to come on. It still does, but the black sister that lost all that weight.
Oh, Jennifer Hudson.
Yeah, Jennifer Hudson. You know, you had a few like that that have come out that you can say is R&B, but they don't really have that, those albums or that staying power that the classic R&B artists have. You know what I mean? So they're still there. They speckle the horizon with hits here and there, but there's no steady folks that you hear in steady airplay on the radio, like talking about it. And that's just my opinion, you know, just my personal opinion. There may be somebody listening that would disagree.
Let me throw this out there. I want to say it was Stephanie Mills. Stephanie Mills was on a talk show, I want to say about 2 weeks ago, and they asked Stephanie Mills the same question I asked you. What happened to R&B music? She said, I'm not quoting her, but it was something to this effect.
Paraphrasing.
R&B music isn't, it isn't our music anymore. They want other people singing R&B music. Then she threw out the names of Justin Timberlake, Dan Sharon. Well, I know she said Justin Timberlake, but then I'm going to add in Ed Sheeran, maybe Christina Aguilera, you know, people like that. She tried to make it seem like it was a racial issue that they wanted, that the industry wants more white people singing R&B music.
Go ahead.
Particularly agree with that, but white kids have grown up listening to more of our music, you know, and being influenced by more of our music. And I think R&B has hit a snag because people really can't sing anymore. And
there you go.
If you if you can't sing, you can't be an R&B artist. Because when you sing a song, we want to feel it. We don't just want to listen to it. We want to feel it. An R&B song is all about feeling, whether it's fast or slow. Because in the 90s, you could go to the club and the DJ could play an hour worth of, he could play an hour worth of R&B jams, and you'll be dancing to the R&B jams, and then he'll follow it up with maybe three or four slow jams, and then he'll go back into the hip-hop stuff. And it was like R&B flowed with the club scene back in the 90s, whereas now it's all about the love, you know, the love catchy little hip-hop songs. And then you got the little Ty Dolla $ign songs mixed in with, you know, the new breezy sound. And then you got the Drake doing his little R&B stuff. So that's what R&B is. It's like rap dudes trying to sing.
And that's very true. And that's very true. And another consideration, too, is that when she says that, I feel what she's saying. But even when she was, when she was singing, wasn't it, what's the old girl, the white chick I used to sing with?
Tina Marie.
Tina Marie.
Tina Marie.
And then you had Wham, you know what I'm saying? They tried to do a little R&B, but they were still like the Justin Timberlake at that time. You have, who else was there? There was, and Who's Your Boy? The white dude, Color Me Bad, they had just came out.
Yeah.
There is, and that this is kind of like the time the boy bands too. So you got to consider a little bit of that New Kids on the Block, and you know they were after her, of course. But my point is, there were still white people, white artists that were still singing R&B, and R&B was still relevant. You know what I'm saying? So I don't think it's them as much as the fact that it's not. I'll piggyback what you just said. We can go to the club right now, right? And they're not going to play one R&B song, right? And if they do play R&B song, the R&B song is going to be closer to a up-tempo
rap song,
rap hip-hop song than anything else, right? So there isn't a, for lack of a better word, there isn't a demand
for
old-school R&B because it's not going to get played in the, it's not going to get played in the club. So when you and I were listening to it and going to the club, we was going in there to find somebody, and when that song came on, we was going to go pull them out on the dance floor. Because there was specific songs that you could slow down to, and it was that time to get it. You know what I mean?
Oh,
but,
man, yeah, because I think we was talking about this. We was like, these kids will never know what a slow dance is.
Never.
Yeah.
They will never know.
Well,
and I think, go ahead.
It's a shame, man. It's just a shame that if it's not rap music or a pop song or country music, because even if you really think about it, rock and roll music is going away. I mean, it's slowly phasing itself out. So it's like rock and roll music and R&B are phasing themselves out at the same time due to, in your word, demand. The demand ain't there, so
exactly
guess
what?
People won't make it. So, but look, man.
Go ahead.
Ben, we're talking about old school and new school. I think this is a topic that me and you both can relate to. You know, us old school cats, we look at Michael Jordan as the best basketball player ever. These new school dudes, they look at LeBron and Kobe as the best players ever. Where you stand at on this topic, bro? Give it to me real, give it to me straight.
I've heard it both ways. There's this dude on ESPN. He's a new dude. I can't think what his name is. He got a new show with who does he sit with? But he's an advocate of LeBron and that he says.
Are you talking about Nick Wright and Chris Carter?
I think that's who it is. Nick Wright, white kid with a little goatee.
First things first. Yeah. Nick Wright. First things first.
Yeah. So if you've heard his commentary, he is very much in the LeBron side of things. And he makes valid points if you're looking at some statistics and looking at what LeBron has done and what he continues to do. And a lot of that goes to the fact that he has played much longer than Michael. He's played more games. And I know in some particular instances, he has beaten Michael's records with less games than Michael did. So there's some, and I don't know the exact statistics off the top of my head right now, but there's some statistics that he's hit and has surpassed that Michael has done in a shorter time frame and those different things. So I give kudos to him, and I give kudos to the fact that he's accomplished so much. I think he's done better over the years, of course, and the way he played the year he won the championship with the Cavs, he stepped up in that game seven, I think it was seven it was. Last year, he tried to do what he could do. Of course, came back out empty-handed. I say all this to say this. I think they touched upon this on this first take show with this cat. If me, I look at body of work and I look at a complete picture, and I need somebody, one person, to ride with to go get me some championships. And all things are even across the board as far as looking at Kobe, LeBron, and Jordan. I'm going to take those three for right now just because you mentioned those three. If I'm a ride with somebody and I'm trying to get some chips, I'm going with Jordan, Kobe, and then LeBron. And I'm going to tell you why. Not because of wins, losses, not because of rings. To me personally, and I've always used this argument, and I'm always going to stand on this argument. Me personally, Kobe and Jordan have that it factor when it comes to that killer instinct. And I feel like those
that
two,
dog.
Regardless.
Go ahead and say it. They got that dog in them.
They got that dog. And I'll give you a perfect example. LeBron got kicked out of his first game a couple weeks back because he was arguing with the ref because he felt like he got fouled. To me, personally, you the biggest thing on the court, the fastest thing on the court, the strongest thing on the court. Nobody should be able to stop you anyway. And I get it. They're trying to make you into a jump shooter. You're not a jump shooter, blah, blah, blah. I get all of that. But if you, the dude, it don't matter how hard they're not really following you that hard compared to what Kobe and Jordan played in. But if you, the dude, and everybody has you up on the throne as being number one, I need you to go to the rack every time and just eat that and just play with a spirit of, it doesn't matter how hard you foul me, what you do, if I don't get the call, I'm putting this on top of your head. You know what I'm saying? And I just don't get that from LeBron. I just don't get that. So, for me, Jordan, Kobe, then LeBron. That's just me. And people are going to disagree and debate. I get it, but.
Yeah. But that's cool, though, because that's why we're talking about it. I mean, you know, it's kind of funny that, you know, me and you hardly ever agree on anything, but
ever.
We actually do agree on this. I have it Mike, Kobe, and LeBron. And a lot of people that know me will probably say I'm taking Kobe because I'm a Laker fan. No, I'm taking Kobe because Kobe had that mindset in him that he was the best player on the court at all the time, at all times. He never wanted to, even when he was playing with Shaq, he felt like he was the best player on the court.
Right.
My thing with Jordan is, man, I'm going to go to LeBron first, then I will come back to Mike. You can't take away LeBron's all-around talent. LeBron is an all-around talent. LeBron can pass it. He can score it. He can defend. He can rebound. LeBron is the total package. You can't deny that. LeBron has been in, what, seven finals in a row soon, maybe eight this year. And then when he bought, I ain't going to say he brought them back single-handedly because Kyrie was on the court. But when he came back from 3-1 to beat the Warriors, that cemented his greatness, you know, to this generation of basketball fans. That was a hell of a comeback. I mean, I never thought they would win. I think we even talked about it on our group text that when Golden State went up 3-1, it was over. So we'll just be watching to see the champagne flow. But, you know, now, Michael Jordan, his airness. Michael Jordan, I think he had to wait 3 years to come out of college. He came out after his junior year. That was when the rule was that, you know, you had to, I think they had suspended coming straight out of high school to go to the pros. So if Mike would have came straight out of high school and could go to the pros, LeBron probably some of Mike's stats would be unreachable. But being that, you know, the rules are the rules, if you look at the biggest stage, Michael Jordan in the finals, 6-for-6, never went to a game 7, 6 finals MVPs. Now, there is one knock against Jordan that I have to say that will always go down probably against one of his biggest knocks. Michael Jordan never said anything about social issues. Michael Jordan never, ever voiced his opinion about things that was going on in society. Whereas LeBron is out in front. He speaks his mind. He's articulate about what he's saying. And, you know, even though in today's age, we're in the social media age, whereas Jordan wasn't, he still had a platform to make statements or, you know, get his opinion. And Kobe was the same way. Kobe really stayed away from, you know, the social issues because of what happened in Colorado, because people would never take what he said seriously until after he retired. If you look at it, if you look at Kobe now, people actually listen to what he's saying, how he go about his business. But when Kobe went through the thing, the girl out here in Colorado, it kind of like, it shook his image for maybe about a good 3 to 5 years. And it took a round for people to come back to him. But Michael Jordan is not just an icon on the court. Michael Jordan is an icon worldwide. When they went to the 92 Olympics, man, people was mobbing their bus just to get a picture of him and the other players, but mostly it was about him. And then when he came out with his own shoe, when he came out with his own shoe, that changed the game. And to me, that's why Mike will always be part of the best basketball player on ever. And he's, I mean, 6 for 6 with 6 MVPs, never went to a game 7. And we didn't even talk about the competition he played against, because the league ain't like it is today. Because this say Mike played in today's game where they can't hand check you, ain't no hard fouls. He would have
right.
He probably would have averaged about 40 a game.
Right, right.
At least 40. Because if I recall correctly, you are a collector of Jordan shoes. So
this is true.
I'm quite sure that didn't sway your opinion. I'm quite sure that didn't sway your opinion.
Of course not. So let
me
ask you this.
It's fun. Go ahead.
So what point were you making as far as him not standing up for social issues? Are you saying that's why he's not number two? Is that one of your reasons?
No. On the reason I said that is because people always look at that as a big negative against him.
Okay.
Because he never voiced his opinion about social issues or what was going on. Whereas in today's game, you have your LeBrons, your Chris Pauls, your Mellos, you have your Steph Currys, you have people like that that's always at the forefront of, you know, going at the president's neck or saying this wrong or that's wrong, whereas Michael Jordan was never like that and Kobe was never like that during his playing days. And I was, you know, when you have these kind of debates, you have to bring that up because in today's society, they do look at those things. You know what I mean? That's why I brought it up.
So I hear what you're saying, but this is a more toxic time than what Jordan, Kobe played in.
True.
What I'm saying? I mean, there was stuff still going on, but let's talk about like Steph Curry. Where else? Well, let's just talk about Steph Curry, and we'll talk about the NFL in general. Where else in history has a president called out an individual personally? You know what I'm saying? So
okay.
It's a little different because
yeah.
The culture is different. But I also preface this statement with this. That may not have been Kobe and Michael's character to be a person to speak out on certain issues or issues of the day. Charles Barkley, yes, because that's just Charles Barkley. He's still like that to this day. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
But you can look
yep.
at Jordan and say he retired, and that's pretty much what Jordan did. He kept true to his character. He bought a basketball team. He's like the general manager or whatever he does over there, president of the team. Or the owner of the team.
He's the owner.
But
yeah.
But what does he do besides manage his team? You don't see him out in front talking about nothing. You don't hear about Jordan doing this or doing that. He's never been that type of person. You know what I'm saying? And Kobe hasn't either. So to say or to speak to that piece to them is that I think even if they played during this time frame, they would still be the same type of individuals. They're just, they separate themselves because all they care about is basketball. That's all they cared about.
True. True.
You know,
but I think today's athlete though, Dre, if Kobe and Michael Jordan were playing today, and they were, and they still had the same skill set, the same talent, I think the public would come down on them for not having a voice. It's
oh,
like
absolutely.
Really, you don't have nothing to say. So
absolutely,
and
they
and
would
I
seek
think,
them out.
And I think the pressure, yeah, the pressure would probably, you know, have them, you know, take a stance or make a statement. You know, whether or not that statement is written by them or their agent or their representative, but public would make them take a stance. And I think President Trump has made athletes take a stance because of his actions and his words. And it's like, I have said this before, and Jerry Jones showed me his true colors. Like, at first he's kneeling down with his players, and then he's going to say anybody that kneels down for the anthem, they won't be able to play. Really? You just knelt down with the players a week ago. So now you get a call from the president, and now you're going to tell the players that if they kneel down or they protest, they ain't going to play. So that's why I tweeted at Tyron Smith, at Ezekiel Elliott, at Dak Prescott, and at Dez Bryant. Won't y'all kneel and see what happens? I guarantee you he don't sit y'all down. Y'all the most popular players on y'all team, and y'all black. But we know Dez ain't going to do it. We know Zeke ain't going to do it because of what he was going through. And then Dak, you know, he's still making his way. But at the same time, it's like, come on, man. Come on, for real.
But you know what? You can still flip that and say even today, Jordan and Kobe are still two very influential people in society, black community, and they still haven't said anything. They haven't came out, spoke out against anything. So I don't think, I think that is just the nature of the beast when it comes to them, that's just not who they are in that context. And that's not a bad thing. That's just, they just choose not to involve themselves in stuff like that. But you have every yin, you have a yang. So people that do that is from, you know, you have, like I said, Charles Barkley. He says enough for everybody. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, he does.
So it's not like it's really something that they need to do. But, again, like I said before, it's a different time frame, and you didn't have a president calling people out and trying to make people bad because of the fact that they're kneeling because of a cause. And that's another thing that pisses me off. And then I'll let you move on to something else, is that on every news channel, I don't care what news channel it is, everybody wants to make it sound like brothers is kneeling because they don't believe in the country or believe in the flag, or we don't respect the people that have died for the flag and all these different things. That is so far from the truth. And the real reason why this all began has gotten lost because of the fact people want to try to make it out to be something else than what it is. The bottom line about it is that as black community, as black people, it's not that we don't respect the people that died for that flag. The fact of the matter is that flag hasn't represented us in various situations throughout society. Yes, we take ownership to the fact that there is a lot of black-on-black crime. We are not ignorant to know that we have, as a society, as a community, we've caused a lot of self-inflicted pain. We get that. But it's also very glaring that the tables are not the same across the board with everybody that's playing the game. And so...
That's right.
Why not? You know what I'm saying? So why not kneel during an anthem that people fail to realize that three or four of the verses to that anthem clearly are
promoted slavery.
Exactamundo. But that was so conveniently taken out, and we're singing about the other part of it. And yes, we know we changed it. Core reasoning for writing the song as it was. You know what I mean? So that's what people are kneeling against, is the idea of what it's supposed to represent is not representing us. You know what I mean? It's not that we're not appreciative, but hey, me and you are both military veterans. We both served our country. We get it. But I'm not offended because a brother is kneeling, because that was a right that we gave, I won't say we gave to them, that we protected for them to be able to express themselves. And for you to take offense to that, you know, is one thing. And then on top of that, how many of you people talking all this noise about kneeling with the flag, how many of y'all standing up when they playing the flag on TV and when you watching the game? Because I know you're going to get your beer. I know you're sitting there eating chips. I know you just ordered some chicken wings and a pizza, sitting there eating it, watching. So you getting mad because they kneeling, but your ass ain't even standing up at the crib? get out of here with that.
They in the stands doing that. And most of them in the stands not even standing up, not even taking off their hats. I mean, me personally I'm a vet just like you. I mean, everything in me says that when I heard the national anthem, I want to kneel. But being that I gave the United States Air Force 22 years of my life, I feel obligated to respect the national anthem. Even though I want to kneel, but I won't kneel. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of conflicted.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, being that we were talking about that, man, I wanted to bring this up. You know, you grew up in Denver back in the 80s and 90s. I grew up in Portsmouth back in the 80s and 90s. Tell the people how it was growing up out here in Denver, Dre, because, you know, I came out here in 2003. And I know it was a culture shock for me, you know, because it was certain things out here that I've never experienced. And it kind of, shook me, but it kind of like, I was like, my eyes were opened a little bit. So tell me how it was for you growing up out here in Denver back in the 80s and 90s.
Well, in all honesty, I left in 89. So like that 90s portion, if I was in the military, out and about doing my military.
Okay,
thing.
So in the 80s then.
So if you're talking about like the 70s, 80s when I was growing up, you know, I grew up in a very sheltered environment. So, you know, a lot of things that I was exposed to really didn't come out until after I left the house. But as a young person growing up, if you're talking like hip-hop music and the culture of, like, my neighborhood and those different type things, you know, it really fell in line with a lot of things that a lot of black people grew up in their homes in different parts of the country in regard to it's just a cultural thing that a lot of black people are familiar with because either all our parents or our parents and grandparents came from the South. So there's
stereotype.
But not stereotype. There is a, what's the word I'm looking for? There's a certain thing that, you know, coming from the South, you learn certain things. So you learn a culture of, you know, working hard. And like my dad, he grew up with 13, 14 brothers and sisters. So they worked the land. So he learned from his dad that, you know, you got to learn a trade. He's very disciplined, a lot of different things. And so a lot of things were given to him as learning about being a man as he moved out and things that, you know, a lot of black people, because of the fact that, you know, coming from the South, there's a lot of different traditions and things that we carried and moved forward as we left and moved to different places. So I say that to say, growing up in Colorado, those basic things that we all are familiar with, I pretty much am familiar with too. But the difference is moving to Colorado, since Colorado isn't a very high culture environment as far as black people is concerned, not like growing up on the East Coast or even the West Coast for that matter, you know, as far as being in touch with like cultural shows and plays and, you know, it was just a different mentality because of the fact that it is in the Midwest. So racism in Colorado is very subtle. It's not up in your face. And that's the worst kind to have because it's so subtle and so low key. You really, really have to be paying attention to it, even though that it's happening compared to like in the South, they pretty much call you the N word in your face. And that's what it is. You know what I mean? So a lot of people were more subjected to in other parts of the country I was subjected to, but on a different level. So I still grew up with R&B music. I still grew up with, you know, hip hop music. It was a little more towards the West Coast because we, you know, a lot of kids in Colorado, either you were an East Coast kid or a West Coast kid, and it's more lean toward the West Coast. So a lot of people listen to that West Coast music, had that West Coast type
mentality and style of clothes. You know, we had gang issues when I was growing up and that type of thing. But overall, if you're coming from the East Coast, you move to Colorado, it's definitely going to be a culture change because you're not going to see as many as us as you would on the East Coast. You're not going to see as many as us like you might see maybe in a California. And I'm not real familiar with California as far as the areas and the community, but since I've been on the East Coast and here, I can definitely tell you there's a difference as far as that goes. But, I mean, overall, it takes some adjusting to the fact of knowing that the climate and the culture and the mindset of Colorado is different than East Coast or a different coast, even, you know, different than being down the South in Atlanta and, you know, in Georgia and Alabama and down in that area.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I know, like, I know when I moved out here, what's going on with your sound, man?
Now that's my bad. Let me move my mic. Is that better?
Yeah.
My bad.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, man. It was just like when I moved out here, and especially after I got to know you, and I was like, man, I had never been in an environment where the game thing was so prevalent. And it was like, man, I remember, I think I had asked you, I was like, man, how did you grow up with this, man? It was like, because I know when I knew you, especially after I met your parents, I was like, I know you wasn't no game banger. So I know you tried to stay as far away as possible from that. So
right.
It was like, man,
affect me and dictate?
Let me put it like this. No. How did you? Oh, no, it's just both of your parents, you know, your sisters. Yes. Oh, I met your sister.
Yep.
I think I only met one of your siblings. But, you know, you.
You're back now. I lost you for like 2 or 3 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead and rephrase what you said, because the last part I heard was that when you first got out there, the whole gang thing, you met a couple of my siblings, and how did I?
Yeah, so as far as you, I knew when I met you that you was into that gang stuff, but I knew where you grew up at in Park Hill, I knew that was prevalent out there where you grew up at. So how did you, like, just tell me about a normal day for Derek Ray going to high school, you know, how was that?
Well, I'm going to tell you something, man. I grew up with a father in my house. And so
exactly.
I was more afraid of my father than I was any gang. You know what I'm saying? So that kept me on the straight and narrow. And then number two, gangs really didn't start kicking in and being an issue until I probably would say 86.
After you left?
Yeah, after
okay.
I left. They started like, so when did Colors come out?
Man, Colors came out, man. That was, man.
84, right?
Yeah, that was like
85.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's
like
when Colors came out. And so that's when the initiation began, and there was a beginning portion of that. And even in that introduction, it was getting bad, but it wasn't bad. So you could still navigate within the streets and still hang out and do a couple of things and really still be safe. But about 85, 86, about my sophomore, junior year, it started getting worse. Now, it wasn't worse to a point where I couldn't go outside, like, you know, in Compton and other parts of L.A. where it was so bad, you know, you really couldn't wear certain colors. We hadn't got there yet, but we were aware of it, and we just started getting used to it. And keep in mind, too, a lot of kids that was claiming blood, I went to school with, so I knew them. A lot of kids that was claiming Crips with some of my family on the other side of town. So the blessing in that was that, you know, I could still go to school, still graduated, all those different things, and we didn't have any major issues like that. Now, after I graduated, about 88, 89, those 90s up to 96, all hell broke loose. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
And an even better person that, to talk to about that would be my sister, because she was at home during all of that. You know what I mean? So that's when it really started getting crazy, and they was really wilding out. But the main reason why I didn't get caught up in that was because I had my dad, and there was a curfew. I wasn't going out and hanging out in the streets when all that stuff was going down. Even when I got 11th and 12th grade, I wasn't going to clubs. I wasn't, you know, hanging out till midnight coming home. That Negro had me in the house every night. You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, it wasn't a point of hanging out with the wrong crowd, because the crowd that I hung out with from freshman up to sophomore, they weren't those type of kids anyway. So it was, I won't say it was easy, but I was blessed by grace for that, you know, all my issues that I had didn't come during high school. They came after I got out of Colorado once I left. All the trouble I got into was after I left the house. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
that's where your boy ended up.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that you say that, because it was like growing up in Portsmouth, you know, in the Seven Cities where you at, a lot of people, you know, only thing they ever relate to is Virginia Beach, because, you know, a lot of people come to Virginia Beach, you know, it's a big tourist place, you know, blah, 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 blah. But what people don't realize about the Seven Cities is, in the Seven Cities, every city is touched by a body of water. So you can touch a body of water in every part of the Seven Cities. So if you can touch every part of a body of water, that means that drugs can come into every city in that area. And when I grew up, the thing was Portsmouth, Virginia, back then we had anywhere from 6 to 8 projects within maybe a 15-mile radius. You know, and the projects, you know, basically everybody in the projects, they were poor, you know, on government assistance, you know, things like that. But there was a code to growing up in Portsmouth. If you was dealing drugs, you didn't sell drugs to somebody else's next part. That was a no-go. If you did that, you was going to get your ass whooped. You might have even got killed. You was definitely going to get robbed. So that was just an unwritten rule. You know, you didn't sell drugs in another person's part. Another thing about growing up in Portsmouth was it forced you to grow up quick, man, because all the stuff you witnessed and you seen, you know, and you know what your family was going through, you know, it kind of forced you to grow up, man, because I know for me, well, my mom worked in the shipyard, and some kind of way she lost her job, and we went from having everything to having nothing, you know, at one point, some points in time, you know, our lights wouldn't be on, you know, we ain't had no hot water, stuff like that. But, you know, we survived. So for me, my getaway became, I'm going to go to school, I'm going to get good grades, and I'm going to get the hell up out of here. I knew I wasn't going to college. I knew that I graduated in 89. I knew in my sophomore year I wasn't going to college. So I said, I got to do something. So I was thinking about, you know, I might go to Job Corps. But, you know, I had a little gig at McDonald's. I was getting paid a little bit of money, you know, thinking I'm balling. That shit won't matter. So one day my mama asked me, she was like, so what you going to do with your life? I didn't have an answer for her, so she came back about 2 weeks later. She said, so what you going to do with your life? And I didn't have an answer for her. So then she asked about a week later. She was like, so what you going to do with your life? I was like, well, I'm waiting on the Air Force to call me. So 2 weeks later, the Air Force recruiter called the house. I was like, how you get this number? He was like, well, you know, the public schools gets numbers to all the graduated school seniors or whatever, whatever. So I ended up going down there talking to him, and, you know, I ended up going in the Air Force. But I say that to say this. Your circumstance of growing up should always lead you to a better path for yourself and your, quote-unquote, future family and kids. You know, a lot of people that get caught up in the system or caught up in the game, they raise their kids in the system and in the game. Why? Do better. You know what I'm saying? Because even when I go home today, there's people where they had their grandma was in the projects, their mama was in the projects, their dad in the projects, and then they kids in the projects. What does the cycle end? The cycle got to end somewhere, you know what I'm saying? So, and it was kind of cool when I met you because me and you came from, like, two different environments, but we had this chemistry because when you moved to out to Langley, we could relate to, you know, you've been up where I've been, I'm where you at, and, you know, it was refreshing to know somebody that been where you been and you where they at, and we could just talk about different shit all the time. Even in those days that you would come to my house and we would just sit in the basement and we would just watch a basketball game, we might not have said 10 words to each other, but you know, we was like, that's my dude, you know, we over here chilling, you know. Well, we ain't gotta talk seriously all the time, we could just joke and laugh.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But I remember going when I was in high school, it wasn't too much joking and laughing. And for me, it was more about I got to take care of business because, you
right.
know, I got to get up out of here. So that's how I grew up. Like, yo, I got to move. I got to go do something. You know,
and
my whole plan was when I got out of Portsmouth, my whole plan was to bring my brother with me. I was going to adopt my brother, become his guardian, and I was going to show him the world, you know, and say, hey, you can do something outside of being a Portsmouth. But, you know, I end up getting married, having kids, having my own family. So, you know, that's the only thing I probably regret is not being able to take my brother with me to see the world. But at the same time, is, you know, I had my life to live.
Right.
What are you doing?
I'm not doing anything. I'm just standing here. Am I still distorted?
It sounds like you scratching. It sounds like
you know what? Because, and that's my bad. You know why? Because my microphone keeps getting close to my neck. I got these Beats joints. That's my bad, yo. My bad, son. My bad. And my bad for the listeners because I hate that too. I hate that when I'm listening to so much of static going back. I apologize sincerely. I'll make sure that next time I don't have such a high call on when I am on the air.
Good, man. You know, we had a good, well, you know, like I put on our title. It's just two old guys just talking. I mean, you know,
hey,
and
you know what?
We just had a good time.
You know what? Before we end, I wanted to say something else, too, what you were saying. You know something about Colorado that I've seen that I haven't seen anywhere else yet? I've been quite a few places, but I can say now and still to this day that Colorado does not have any project. Now, when I say projects, some people may try to debate me that are from Colorado and mention certain areas like Swansea. There's some areas that used to be down in the Five Points area. And I believe some spots in Mount Bell, but not really, but more in the downtown area. However, when I say project.
Hold on, what about those joints on Mariposa behind that Burger King?
Well, I'll let you define that because this is what I'm gonna say. When you say projects, when I think of projects and from where I've been
Chicago, Caprina Green, which isn't there anymore, Projects, Houston, the Wards, Projects VA on this side, what used to be over there, what used to be over here, huh?
The ones on Jefferson Drive?
Those, and the one where Bubba Chuck grew up in, across the street over there by Coliseum Gardens.
Yeah, yep.
Those over there. And then in New York, of course, certain areas, cities built specific areas, high-rise areas, specific locations in neighborhoods and neighborhoods and or downtown areas of cities for low-income people,
yep,
primarily minorities,
yep,
right? So
yep,
there
yep
are cities specifically where projects, when you think of projects, there are a certain way projects look. You know what I mean? How they're
yep
built, how they're located, and the whole nine. So there's a difference, in my opinion, there's a difference between, and we'll even say, like, the closest thing, like with California, and I'm just going off of what I've seen on TV. I've never been in Compton or any of those areas of L.A., but I'm assuming from the pictures and stuff I've seen, they have projects also. However, the projects that I define and understand from what I've seen and what I've researched, Colorado doesn't have anything like that. There's not an area in Colorado, from what I know, now and going back, even growing up, where I couldn't walk through there at a certain time of night. There may be some pockets now since I've been gone, and I'm not really in them lanes like that anymore, but you can't tell me in Denver there is a location where they say you do not go there after 10 o'clock.
That's a true statement. I have to agree with you. I mean,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, when I moved out here, I was shocked. I was like, damn, they don't have projects out here. But then, you know, it's one little, and actually, you know what, maybe it's not the projects, but it reminded me of the projects back at home.
Mm-hmm.
It was off of Mariposa. It was off, you go down Colfax and you make a left
mm-hmm
at Burger King on Mariposa. And it's right
down
there
by,
but you know,
down
man,
there by the
by
metro
convention center, yeah, by the convention center.
Mhm. Mhm.
Yeah, but you know what? I gotta agree, man. It's like Denver really doesn't have projects, and then most of the Section 8 people, you know, that the low income people, they live in houses. It ain't like they live in projects, because
mm-hmm
as me and you both know, when the housing market crashed, a lot of Section 8 people ended up moving out of Green Valley Ranch, because Green Valley Ranch was supposed to be the new Highlands Ranch. And for people who don't know, Highlands Ranch is one of the high-income neighborhoods or subdivisions in Denver where, you know, they got nice houses and nice mall and all this. And Green Valley Ranch was supposed to be in that. But when the market crashed, they had to do something with all those houses, so they end up being Section 8 for low-income families. But at the same time as now, they want the Section 8 folks out of Green Valley Ranch so that the people who own the houses, they can get the houses sold because they done built it up so much. But, you
yep
know, that's a discussion
yep
for another day. But, you know, you right, man. It was crazy because Denver – oh, I just say Denver and Aurora combined because they, you know, I just look at them as the same. There
they
aren't any
no
projects out here. No
mm-hmm
projects.
Now, there's some technically, quote-unquote, run-down neighborhoods. You know what I mean? But they don't go for blocks.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So you may see...
Yeah.
You may see one or two together on the same block, but... They don't go for a whole section, three or four blocks like you might go to.
It ain't like that.
Flint.
Even Montbello
yeah
not like that.
Right.
Because Montbello,
right,
you know, they got apartment complexes in Montbello. but they're not considered projects because of the style of the apartments. And because when you think of projects, you think of maybe 8 to 10 buildings, 10 to 15 buildings, whereas out here, most apartment complexes at the most, you would get, what, 6 to 8 buildings, you know?
Yep.
And if it's a nice neighborhood, a nice apartment complex, it may be 8 to 10, but it's not considered a project. It's just considered a nice apartment complex because
right.
That's one of the things that people don't realize about Denver is Denver don't want to, and I like this about Denver, they don't want, when you come out here, they don't want to say that you went to the hood.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's their perception. They don't want you to say you've been to the hood or you rolled through the hood because ain't no hoods really out here. I mean, you mm-hmm. got neighborhoods, you got subdivisions, you got stuff like that, but ain't really no hoods out here. And, you know, just to lighten it up, you know, I know we've been talking seriously here for the last maybe about 10, 15, 20 minutes. But, you know, me and Dre grew up in a time where this is a hard right turn, folks. Me and Dre grew up in a time where the mixtape was really a mixtape. You know, you had a DJ cutting and scratching and, you know, bringing in the next song, you know, blending and, you know, got your head shaking. And the mixtape was the thing. And growing up in Portsmouth, every Friday night, we had a DJ named the Soul Ranger. And he would do the Friday night mix. And I remember those nights I would sit up and I would hit the record button and then pause it during the commercials and restart it. Man, mixtapes were really mixtapes. Nowadays, mixtapes are looked at as, you know, a way of people to get their music out. You know, they free. You know, a lot of artists like to collaborate on mixtapes. But when I think of mixtapes, I think of DJing. And that's like a lost art nowadays, Dre. What happened to the DJ, man?
Same thing that happened.
I know
to,
you.
Same thing that happened.
I know
to
you turned me on the DJ Juice. You turned me on the Juice because you had maybe about 3 or 4 of his old joints, and I think we had went to your house. No, I was riding with you when you had the. Was it an Intrepid? What you had?
Yeah, might have been the Intrepid.
Yeah, you had the Intrepid, and we was rolling one day, and I was like, yo. Where you get this at? And he was like, yo, this DJ Juice from back in the day. And I was like, man, this that shit I love right here, dog. So, yeah, now, man, what happened to the mixtape game, man?
Like, just like I said before, the same thing that happened to vinyl. You know what I'm saying? Hip-hop, it you know, it changes. It expands. It grows. It morphs into what not only the creators and or the artists develop, but it also morphs into what the record labels and the money want it to be. So, and also you gotta think about it too, you know, technology change. So it's no longer you having to reach down from the crate and put the record on and have your little pieces of tape on the record where you knew the breaks were, and have the speed written on the record,
yeah.
75 RPMs or 32 RPMs and all that. It's
yeah.
all done for your computer. So, you know, most DJs, and I'm not knocking them, it's just, you know, what the technology is nowadays. Most of them using an Apple laptop with one turntable, and, you know, it shows you on your computer where the best place is to put the break and where the song should blend in. And so whenever you simplify art form, there's going to be some creativity lost in it. You know what I'm saying? So it's...
Man, that's sad, though, Dre. So you remember, man, you remember, like, the key components for, you know, hip-hop back in the day? It was the DJ. I mean, you had Jam Master J,
You had DJ Hurricane with the Beastie Boys. You had LL, who had two DJs. He had, I can't even think of his name right now. LL had two DJs. And then, you know, you had Eric B. and Rakim. You had Terminator X. You had
DJ Red Alert.
DJ Jazzy Jeff. You had Red Alert. And you had DJs that could really, like, man, be cutting and scratching and had a party going. And nowadays, it's like the mixtape game is all about is free music, people trying to launch their career. The mixtape game ain't what it used to be, man. It ain't about DJing skills, man. I mean, to me, a lot of people love DJ Clue. Me personally, I have never been a fan of DJ Clue because I could do what Clue did. It was like, you know, he'd have an exclusive. And then he'd say, this is a new joint from so-and-so. DJ Clue, that's a storm. Then he'd roll into the, that's not DJing. But I'm going to take you back to a night that me and you did, that me and you went out together. When Kid Capri came to Denver. Tell the people, Dre. tell about that night.
Well, first of all, Swill would whoop your ass right now because he was there that night too. Because me and Swill always talk about this night too, so you got to include Swill in that.
Nah, he ain't go that time. It was just me and you.
No, there was no.
No, the first time he came out here, I didn't go. Because he was
My bad. My bad. You talking about when Clue came out?
The first time he came out here, he was at Vinyl. I didn't go.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah, you talking about the night he came out and did the concert. And it was funny because, you know, everybody that knows anything about hip hop knows who Clue is. And Clue came out to Denver to do a concert, and it was a large venue. And the joint wasn't even packed out. And it wasn't because by any stretch of imagination.
Capri.
It wasn't because Capri is whack by any stretch of imagination. It's the fact that we actually came up against the age barrier and the change of understanding of music and what music is about. You know what I mean? So even millennials that understand what hip hop is about, that understand the culture, would be there for Clue. I don't know why you want to say Clue, for Capri, because they know the impact Capri has on impact and his skill set and what he's done. But me and Bo were just so surprised at why the joint wasn't packed out. You know what I mean? And honestly, I think, you know, you can factor in a couple other things too. He's in Denver, you know what I'm saying? So Denver has a smaller hip-hop community as it is. And number two, a lot of
cats... They got a West Coast vibe out here.
Exactly. They got a West Coast vibe out there, which isn't a bad thing by any stretch of imagination. But you just have to consider who your audience is and what the people are calling for. And if I remember correctly, if I'm wrong, he hasn't been back out there again since. For a concert.
Nope.
You know what I'm saying?
The last DJ that came out here to do a show, DJ Rectangle, and he was at the place across the street from Vinyl.
Oh, what used to be Safari.
No, the place that me and you went at that one night, I can't think of the name of it, but
yeah,
he was there.
It used to be. Yeah, it used to be Safari, and then it changed to, I can't think of the name of it, because it's not open anymore. What was it?
No, it's I remember, I think me and you had went there one night. I can't think of the name of it. The name escapes me, but, yeah, DJ Rectangle came out here, but he was the last probably big-time DJ to come do a show out here since Capri. But for the audience, me and Dre, we had so much fun that night. And it was all because of a DJ. It wasn't a group.
It wasn't a singer. It was just a man up there with his vinyl and his two turntables and a microphone. And Kid Capri rocked out for, I want to say it was at least 2 hours. Because we got there, I think we got there about 9:30. And, you know, we was perusing around the venue. And then, you know, it was like, Kid Capri. You know, he was warming up the crowd. And then he finally came on stage. And, oh, my goodness gracious. I was mad because I missed him the first time. Because they went to Vinyl. We still have this club called Vinyl here in Denver. On Thursday nights, it was reggae on the roof. And they didn't even advertise it on the radio that he was going to be the guest DJ. That night, I think a couple of my boys from the crew, they went out. I know Preem had went, and I know you had went. And I was like, and then the next day on our group email, it was like, y'all missed the show last night. Kid Capri was at Vinyl. And I was like, man, get the hell out of here. And that was at the time that Vinyl probably was the number one party spot in Denver. 2-for-1 Long Island, 2-for-1 beers. Man, it was just crazy. But
man,
I'll tell you what,
some of the best nights ever happened in Vinyl. some of the most epic nights ever in life happened in that joint. And that night Kid Capri came. They did that so nice because, and this is the thing, is that we were just listening to music, but then you could tell that there was a change because the breaks were different, the songs was different, and all of a sudden the vibe went up like from a 5, 6, 7 straight to a 15. And I looked at Swill and I was like, "Yo," because we was already hyped. And it was already gradually getting there. And then all of a sudden, it was just the music, it just the whole tone, the whole environment just changed. And I looked at Swill, and we both turned around, and there was that light skinned nigga Kid Capri up there cutting it up. And I was like, yo.
Oh man, I'm so mad I missed that shit. Oh
man,
my God,
I said, yo,
shit.
I need another Long Island. But we didn't get off the floor, yo. We did not get off the floor at all the whole time because there was no break. You couldn't go get a breath nowhere. You weren't going to lose your spot on the floor. There was no way to get off the floor because the floor was packed. And this dude just kept putting record after record after record on. And all you could do is just keep nodding your head. I think he played right up until the doors opened up. Yo, it was literally bananas up in that joint.
And that's crazy because, you know, because we used to go to Vinyl, it was like they closed at 2 o'clock. So, you know, they normally start turning the lights on at 1. So last call was probably about 12:45. Then you was heading down the stairs about 1:15. So, but that night, y'all said he played to 1:30, 1:45?